Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has expressed deep concern about the developments in Jenin in the occupied West Bank, where Israeli airstrikes have hit a densely populated refugee camp. In a statement from a spokesperson on Monday, Mr. Guterres affirmed that all military operations must be conducted with full respect for international humanitarian law. The UN's Humanitarian Affairs Coordination Office, OCHA, said on Tuesday that due to air and ground operations taking place in the West Bank town, 10 Palestinians, including 3 children, have been killed, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health. OCHA warned that most of the Jenin camp has lost access to drinking water and electricity. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization, WHO, said on Tuesday that the extent of people's injuries was placing strain on the fragile and underfunded health system, and that it was working with partners to deliver more life-saving medical supplies to Jenin Hospital. WHO said ambulances with medical teams have been prevented from entering parts of the refugee camp and reaching those critically injured. At least 2 hospitals have also been affected by attacks involving use of ammunition and gas canisters. WHO called for respect and protection of healthcare, including safe passage to health services in Jenin and across Palestine. The El Niño weather pattern has developed in the Pacific Ocean for the first time in 7 years, increasing the likelihood of more heat and new temperature records, the World Meteorological Organization, WMO, said on Tuesday. WMO Secretary General Professor Pedro Italis said that governments should step up efforts to limit the impacts of El Niño on human health, ecosystems, and the economy. And he added that early warnings and anticipatory action of extreme weather events were vital to save lives and livelihoods. Global temperatures are likely to surge as El Niño will add to man-made greenhouse gas-induced atmosphere warming. According to WMO, there is a high probability that one of the next 5 years will be among the warmest on record. The health impacts of El Niño are cause for concern for WHO, which said on Tuesday that increases in food insecurity and malnutrition among the most vulnerable, as well as outbreaks of waterborne diseases such as cholera and mosquito-borne diseases, including malaria, were to be expected. WHO also warned against possible disruptions of national health services due to lack of water supply in drought situations or damage to health infrastructure by floods and cyclones. In Tajikistan, criminalizing the legitimate work of human rights defenders goes against international law, a group of UN-appointed independent human rights experts said on Tuesday. The experts, including Mary Lawler, the special rapporteur on the situation of human rights defenders, had raised with the Tajik government the cases of 8 journalists, bloggers, lawyers, and civil society representatives allegedly sentenced to prison terms of up to 29 years in 2022. They were all involved in defending human rights in the Gorno-Badakhshan Autonomous Region and had been accused of extremism and terrorism-related offenses. The rights experts expressed grave concern about the apparent use of anti-terrorism legislation to silence criticism and said that fair trial standards had been violated. Several of the human rights defenders had been subjected to enforced disappearance and torture in detention, the experts said. They reported that they had contacted the government of Tajikistan about the alleged violations. Dominika Tomaszewska-Mortimer, UN News.
Roger Revelle, in 1956, is asking to understand the impact of increased warming in the Arctic. So he says, we are now the greatest maritime nation on Earth. If the Russian coastline increases by something like 2,000 miles or so, the Russians will become a great maritime nation. Therefore, he needs money to study climate change.
On the next broadcast of TUC Radio.
Coming to you live from Northeast Jefferson County, Kansas. Your one true voice in Kansas. This is the Radio Free Kansas.
Good afternoon, listeners. That is the promo for the second hour TUC Radio. It's coming up here after Radio EcoShock. It is an incredible startup after a wild weekend. I don't hear in Northeast Kansas. We had 2 major storms come through here. One 80 mile per hour winds from the west going east to northeast. Friday or Saturday night. It was one of the longest insurrection July 4th holidays, Insurrection Day, July 4th. One of the longest ones, it seems to me, I've ever had. It's certainly the most certainly the most stormy that I've ever seen in a long time. Last night, it wasn't quite as bad, but nonetheless, it was a huge thunderstorm front that came through here. It encompassed most of the corner of the state, including as far down as my old hometown in Coffee County. Burlington and Leroy, all those areas, they all got it. Well, coming up, we did manage to get the latest Democracy Now! Headlines that came up this morning. And we've got them here for you. And a reminder that tomorrow on Law and Disorder Radio, Thursday, here at RFK, we're going to have a new tax cast that just came in at the end of the month, and it will be premiered. They only come out once a month from the Tax Justice Network, and I've shagged it for you for tomorrow, for the second hour tomorrow, Law and Disorder Radio. So let's get on with the show. Tristan, let's hit the latest Democracy Now! From this morning.
How do we stop ourselves sleepwalking into another Great Depression?
It's breathtaking. You know, for folks that are listening to this, I don't know if they realise the extent of the tax injustice issue, that you've got these major corporations and rich people that go offshore with the money. People get away with it.
World leaders meet and they discuss the big issues, inequality, climate crisis, but the whole thing is a charade.
I think prison should be very real for accounting professionals who advise on aggressive tax avoidance schemes, without a doubt.
What we know about how the mainstream media reported on the financial crisis is that the deeper structural problems with the banking sector weren't really covered.
The majority of the public now understand that there is an emergency. People need to know that there's something that can be done.
There is a new dawn which is happening. The resistance is coming from the old guard.
This opens up a crucial debate about how humankind wants to develop over the course of the coming century.
Join me, Naomi Fowler, and John Christensen for the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. We talk about how we take back control from the super rich and powerful and make our economies work for all of us. You can find us on most podcast apps, and your favourite radio station can broadcast us for free. Get more information on us on www.taxjustice.net/TaxCast. See you then.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel says it's withdrawn from the occupied West Bank city of Jenin following a brutal two-day raid that killed at least 12 Palestinians in Jenin and one in Ramallah. Scores more were injured. It was the worst Israeli attack on the West Bank in 20 years. Thousands are taking part in a funeral procession today for the victims. Jenin's mayor lamented the UN has, quote, failed us and accused Israel of war crimes. The raid came after over a year of deadly Israeli military attacks. This is an injured elderly resident of Jenin speaking while the assault was still ongoing.
They are attacking unarmed people. They use planes and rockets. This is not supposed to happen in the camp. Nothing is safe in the camp. They dug up the camp with bulldozers. Why? What did the camp do?
Meanwhile, Israel launched airstrikes on Gaza earlier today in response to rocket fire from the besieged enclave. On Tuesday, Israel's far-right national security minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, called on civilians to carry guns after a car ramming and stabbing attack in Tel Aviv claimed by Hamas. At least 8 people were wounded. On Sunday, Israel announced it's buying an additional 25 F-35 Lockheed Martin stealth fighter jets from the United States, bringing its arsenal to 75 jets. The deal is financed through U.S. military aid to Israel. France remains roiled by nationwide protests following the police killing last week of Nahel Merzouk, a 17-year-old teenager of North African descent. Some 3,400 people have been arrested in recent days as tens of thousands of police descended on French streets. Thousands of vehicles have been burned and homes and businesses damaged. Prosecutors are investigating the death of a 27-year-old who was hit by a projectile, likely fired by riot police during street clashes. The killing of Merzouk has thrust long simmering tensions around racism and the French police into the spotlight.
Imagine if that had been my brother, my little or my big brother, in the street because we refused to comply. I mean, we are not safe here. We should be safe with the police, but we are scared of them. That is not normal.
We'll go to France for the latest later in the broadcast. In Ukraine, at least 43 people, including 12 children, were injured in a Russian attack in the northeastern Kharkiv region today. Russia has accused Ukraine, aided by the U.S. and NATO, of launching a drone attack on Moscow, leading to the temporary closure of an international airport Tuesday. Kyiv has not claimed responsibility for the attack. Meanwhile, Ukraine has been holding emergency drills after warning Russia may blow up the Zaporizhia nuclear plant, the largest nuclear plant in Europe. On Saturday, the Ukrainian writer Victoria Amelina died as a result of injuries from a Russian strike on a restaurant in Kramatorsk last week, which killed 13 people. Amelina was part of a human rights group, Truth Hounds, investigating Russian war crimes. She was at a restaurant meeting with a Colombian delegation. She was remembered by her peers during a funeral service in Kyiv Tuesday.
It was important to her to travel to the deoccupied areas and gather testimonies about Russia's crimes and tell the world about it as much as she can. We did not only lose a writer and poet in her prime, but also a human rights defender, an honest and shining voice on the international stage.
This comes as prominent Russian journalist Elena Milishina was violently attacked along with attorney Alexander Nemov while on their way to the court sentencing of a human rights activist in Grozny, Chechnya's capital. Unknown assailants beat them, shaved off Milishina's hair, and doused her in blue paint. She reports for the Novaya Gazeta, described the harrowing attack from the hospital where she was being treated.
It was like a classic kidnap, like the ones they used to do. It just hasn't happened in a long time. They came, threw the taxi driver out of the car. They got in, put my head down and tied my hands. They put me on my knees and a pistol to my head.
Elena Milishina was reporting in Chechnya on the LGBTQ community. Back in the United States, the Supreme Court on Friday blocked President Biden's student debt relief plan, which sought to cancel up to $20,000 in individual loans, adding up to over $400 billion of federal student debt. The 6-3 decision by the ultra-conservative-led court came as a major blow to some 40 million qualified borrowers. President Biden announced his administration would pursue a new path for debt relief.
The so-called Higher Education Act. That will allow Secretary Cardona, who's with me today, to compromise, waive, or release loans under certain circumstances. This new path is legally sound. It's going to take longer, but in my view, it's the best path that remains to providing for as many borrowers as possible with debt relief.
While three civil rights groups filed a complaint against Harvard with the Department of Education arguing Harvard's legacy admissions policy discriminates against applicants of color, after the Supreme Court ruled last week colleges cannot use affirmative action in their admissions. 70% of legacy students at Harvard are white, and candidates with family ties are more than five times as likely to be admitted than non-legacy applicants. In another setback for equal rights, the Supreme Court also ruled Friday in favor of a Christian Colorado web designer who refused to create websites for same-sex couples, even though the state banned such discrimination. The justices were again divided 6-3 along ideological lines. Liberal Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote in the dissent, the decision was heartbreaking and a, quote, reactionary exclusion, unquote. Following Friday's rulings, California Congressmember Ro Khanna and other Democrats Democrats reintroduced a bill imposing an 18-year term limit on Supreme Court justices and giving presidents two appointments during a White House term. President Biden last week said the current Supreme Court is, quote, not a normal court, but rejected calls to expand it. We'll have more on the latest Supreme Court rulings later in the broadcast. It was another deadly Independence Day weekend as at least 15 people were killed in a spate of shootings across the U.S. In Philadelphia, an AR-15 toting gunman in a bulletproof vest shot and killed five people and injured two boys in an apparently random mass shooting Monday. In Fort Worth, Texas, an armed attack following Independence Day festivities claimed another three lives. These came after two people were killed and at least 28 injured, including many children, by gunfire at a Baltimore block party. At least five people were shot dead across Chicago over the holiday weekend. During a speech at the National Education Association Tuesday, President Biden again called on Congress to pass stricter gun control legislation.
Arming teachers is not the answer. Arming teachers is not the answer. Banning assault weapons, high-capacity magazines, extensive background checks, they're part of the answer.
A federal judge has blocked parts of Florida's new election law, including a provision barring non-U.S. citizens and people convicted of certain felonies from collecting or handling voter registration materials. U.S. District Judge Mark Walker slammed the law as, quote, Florida's latest assault on the right to vote. Tuesday, July 4th, was the hottest day ever recorded around the world, with the average global temperature reaching 62.92 degrees Fahrenheit, according to data from the U.S. National Centers for Environmental Prediction. The previous record of 62.62 degrees was reached one day earlier, Monday, as heat waves scorched multiple regions across the globe. Here in the U.S., millions of people have been under excessive heat warnings in the south and west of the country. Meanwhile, wildfire smoke from Canada continues to plague large sections of the United States. Wildfires are also burning in Colorado and Washington state. The International Atomic Energy Agency has approved Japan's plan to dump over 1 million metric tons of treated radioactive water from the Fukushima nuclear power plant into the Pacific Ocean. The water has been in storage following the 2011 tsunami and nuclear disaster there. This is IAEA Chief Rafael Grossi.
It's not the IAEA decision. It's a decision by the government of Japan. If the government decides to proceed with it, the IAEA will be permanently here, reviewing, monitoring, assessing this activity for decades to come.
The plan has drawn ire from China and South Korea, as well as smaller Pacific Island nations, environmentalists, and a large section of people in Japan. The treated water still contains tritium, a byproduct of nuclear fission, which has been linked to cancer. The UN Security Council voted to end its decades-long peacekeeping presence in Mali after Mali's military junta told the 13,000-troop international force to leave. Mali suffered deadly attacks from armed rebel groups across its north and central regions following an uprising in 2012. The security crisis has led to back-to-back coups in 2020 and 2021. In addition to the UN forces, an estimated 1,000 fighters from Russia's Wagner mercenary group remain in Mali. Earlier this year, a UN report found Wagner soldiers took part in an attack on the village of Morda last year, which killed 500 people, mostly civilian. Guatemala has begun a review of its ballots from its presidential election after the party of frontrunner, former First Lady Sandra Torres, and her allies challenged the results of June's first round. Protests erupted in Guatemala City over the weekend after the Constitutional Court suspended the certification of the results, which put the progressive candidate Bernardo Arevalo of the Semilla Party in second place, sending him to the runoff in August against Sandra Torres. Rights groups have urged the court to respect the will of millions of Guatemalans who took to the polls last month. This is a Semilla attorney.
What is clear is that the slogan of the official party, supported by parties close to the ruling party, is to manage to open as many boxes as possible that will allow them to declare the electoral process null and void so that the election can be repeated.
Bernardo Arevalo is the son of the first democratically elected president of Guatemala, Juan José Arévalo, who pushed for revolutionary social reforms when he was in office from 1945 to 51. And in Brazil, former far-right president Jair Bolsonaro has been banned from running for public office until 2030. Brazil's electoral court found Bolsonaro guilty of abuse of power and fueling disinformation in last year's presidential election, which he lost to Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Newsflash. Extreme heat is bubbling up everywhere in the Northern Hemisphere and even in the South. Here are tweets for a single week, the last week of June 2023, from weather historian Maximiliano Herrera and other sources. Texas and the U.S. South, at least a dozen dead as heat dome bakes southern U.S. for weeks. Northern Canada, exceptional heat breeding unstoppable fires continues in the Canadian North. Portugal and Spain, record heat wave in the Algarve in Portugal, smashing all records, and 20 heat records broken in Spain. Austria, Herrera says, absolutely mind-blowing heat record in Austria. Just before midnight, Oberndorf rose to 36.1 degrees C, beating its monthly heat record. It is one of the highest temperatures ever recorded in Europe at midnight, and one of the very few cases a record is broken in the nighttime. Morocco, WX weatherman Scott Duncan reports, extreme heat in northwest Africa. Morocco has just observed its hottest day on record. 48.5 degrees C breaks the previous national June record by 1.6 degrees C set in 2012. Saudi Arabia, according to The Guardian, more than 2,000 people suffered heat stress during the Hajj pilgrimage, Saudi officials said on Thursday, after temperatures soared to 48 degrees C or 118 degrees Fahrenheit. Iran. Eastern Iran is also living the harshest heat wave in its history, with weeks of relentless record heat, breaking all records. Northern India, punishing relentless heat continues. China, more records in China, stifling hot and humid night at Shanghai. Several hundreds of records have been falling in China since the first day of the month, and more are coming. Australia, and it's their winter. Queensland and more hit new records high like 32 degrees C, 89 degrees Fahrenheit, again in winter. Japan, extraordinary heat wave in Japan, records fall by the dozens every day. Caribbean, never-ending heat record in the Dominican Republic, under heat waves for months. South America, summer and winter in South America. There you go, a trip around the world in record-setting heat. It doesn't make the news, and nothing is being done about it. Let's get to our important guests. You always hear about climate change or maybe extinctions by the end of this century or beyond. But what if that horror comes much sooner, during your own life? What is really possible if things go from bad to worse? A shocking new peer-reviewed paper was just published in Nature Communications. The title is Earlier Collapse of Anthropocene Ecosystems, Driven by Multiple Faster and Noisier Drivers. We have reached the lead author. Simon Wilcock is Principal Research Scientist at Rothamsted Research, the oldest agricultural research institute in the world. He is also Professor of Sustainability at Bangor University in Wales. From the UK, Simon Wilcock, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much. And just so you know, it's published in Nature Sustainability. That's a different journal.
Ah, Nature Sustainability. Thank you very much for that. Simon, this paper coming out just now, well, it ruined my vacation. I was going to take some time off, but this is too important. It is exactly what many of our listeners feared. You really think the climate could be more threatening much sooner than we have been led to believe?
So what we looked at was how effectively the climate and other pressures might then affect ecosystems. So there's quite a lot of work on tipping points and regime shifts to do with the climate and the atmospheric system, but we focused more on terrestrial systems and so stuff that people are degrading. And we basically looked at whether multiple pressures, so for example, adding climate change on top of the pressure of deforestation, on top of the pressure of hunting, and then throwing in a few extreme events, all of which happen in the real world and becoming more intense and more frequent, how that would affect ecosystem collapse. And it brought them worryingly closer to the present day.
Well, maybe we should take a look at one of the case studies in your paper, and you've kind of alluded to it already. Could you talk about the factors that could bring rapid decline in the great Amazon rainforest?
So the Amazon, is quite well known for being under pretty horrendous pressure. So it's being deforested at quite high rates. The parts that aren't being deforested, many of those parts are being degraded. So, you know, not completely cut down, but damaged in some way. Then it's experiencing quite a lot of extreme temperatures or droughts. And whenever there's a drought now in the Amazon rainforest turns from a carbon sink, so it turns from absorbing carbon to emitting carbon. And other pressures include hunting, mining, and then there's the extreme events. So like we're currently in an El Nino year, so we're expecting, you know, quite severe weather in the Amazon this year. These all add up to put the Amazon under a lot of pressure. And there was a paper last year that came out that showed that the resilience of the Amazon forest is declining. And basically, that's a warning sign. Like, if the Amazon is becoming less resilient, and then it's less able to cope with these stresses. And then combine that with our paper that shows when there are multiple stresses, the collapses happen sooner, that's when things start to get really worrying.
You also studied the second largest lake in India, although it's called the Chilika, I believe that's how it's pronounced, the Chilika Lagoon. In the West, few people have heard about it. It sounds like an odd choice for a study. Why there?
Primarily because one of my co-authors, Greg Cooper, he did his PhD focused on that lake. So many of the models that we use to look at tipping points and ecosystem collapse, many of those models are actually quite simple. Whereas the model that Greg built in his PhD that looked at that lake, it was really very complicated. It had lots of interactions between the fisher people around that lake and also the ecosystem in that lake and the sea washing into the lagoon. It's a very, very complex model. So by focusing on that model, we could effectively check that the simpler models that we also included in the paper were giving us similar answers. And if we got similar answers from the more simple models and the more complex models, then that implies that potentially we're onto something and we start to then believe the result.
In March 2021, I interviewed a young climate scientist, Johannes Lohmann, he was a postdoc at Denmark's Niels Bohr Institute at the time. And Johannes studied past glacial abrupt climate changes. He warned Earth could hit tipping points much sooner than expected, partly due to the rate of climate change. What are some of the problems with the speed that climate change is developing?
Essentially, when things happen, so we looked at two things in our system. We looked at rate and noise and cumulative stress. So what we found in our paper is there's a couple of ways to trigger a collapse. One of which is just sheer pressure, cumulative stress, the equivalent of the straw that broke the camel's back. The other of which is rate. So effectively swamping the system just by the change is just too quick for the system to keep up, for it to buffer itself. And that is, well, the opposite of having a frog in boiling water, right? A frog in boiling water slowly gets used to it. And just like you, when you step into a bath, if you stayed in the bath and slowly heated it up, you'd probably be all right. But if it's slightly hot and you just sort of jump in, you feel that it's really, really hot and you have to jump out straight away. And that's essentially because the change in temperature was too quick for you. And ecosystems are just the same.
But in fact, your team and like-minded colleagues have abandoned the term tipping point. Why and what should we be talking about?
We avoided the phrase, in the paper because it's to prove a tipping point, it gets quite mathematical. You have to prove what's called this hysteresis loop. That effectively means that in one direction, it takes a different amount of energy, effort, to move the system in one direction to another. A good example of something with a hysteresis loop is the rubber band, right? Very simple rubber band. To move it in one direction, you've got to stretch it out. That takes quite a lot of effort, depending on how big the rubber band is. But then when you let it go, it takes absolutely no effort to watch it snap back. Like, it does that by itself. And in this paper, we didn't run the models in both directions. So we didn't, like, prove that hysteresis. But we picked models that effectively had hysteresis shown in them previously. So these models are showing tipping points, but all the catastrophic collapses that we picked up were not necessarily part of tipping point cycles. Essentially, they were just very extreme collapses. So we focused on the language around threshold-dependent changes. So we crossed this threshold, and then there was an extreme collapse in the ecosystem, but essentially the two often go hand in hand.
But Simon, could Earth have as yet unknown systems acting like built-in brakes, a reaction that might slow down the rate of warming and eco-decline warned about in this new science?
Yes, there could be like balancing feedback loops that we don't know about and that potentially weren't in the models. So that's always possible. And, you know, it's not all bad news. Like, tipping points don't all have to be bad. You could argue that the spread of mobile phones across the world, that's quite a positive tipping point. And like I said, that it does have some kind of a hysteresis loop. Like, everyone goes out and buys a smartphone, and then it's very, very difficult to then take all those smartphones away from people because they've got used to them in their daily lives. Tipping points don't have to be bad. And if we seek to understand them, that maybe we can start to pull the right levers and push the right buttons to use tipping points to recover ecosystems. So potentially, you know, we can have unexpectedly quick recovery if we understand how to trigger positive tipping points rather than the ones that make the news now are effectively the negative tipping points. And they're the ones we have more information on because of the stress that we're putting our ecosystems under.
When trying to figure out how quickly ecological catastrophe could arrive, a second essential concept is sort of convergence and the interaction of a wide range of drivers. And in the paper, you break these up into primary drivers, secondary drivers, and noise. Let's start with primary versus secondary drivers. What is the difference, and can you give us some examples?
Yeah, so essentially, that's almost an artifact of the way the models were built and designed. So earlier I said most studies looking into tipping points, a lot of them use quite simple models. And so that's because it's easier for us to understand what's going on in a system if we simplify it. So the simplest system you can sort of simplify it down to is there's one stress and it's causing damage to a system, an ecosystem. It's making the system lose resilience, and then we see what happens, and that may be a tipping point. And so a lot of the models were built in that way. So they're like thinking, I want to understand the stress of, for example, increased population on the fish population in a lake in India, for example. But whilst that's useful for helping us understand that particular stress, it doesn't reflect the real world in the same way. Because that just doesn't happen. That stress in that isolated way just doesn't tend to happen in the real world. There's always another stress as well, or occasionally something else happens. And so that's where these secondary and tertiary stresses come into it. So effectively, there were other variables in the model that we could alter. But maybe the model wasn't designed when it was originally built with those variables being altered in mind, but they could be altered in a way to replicate a stress on a slightly different part of the system, so the actions of a different stress. And so by doing that, we were able to basically better simulate the stresses that are happening in the real world, which are complex, and, you know, there's many at a time. And hopefully that then makes the output from the model a bit more representative of what is happening in the real world, even if the results are a little bit worrying.
The third type of driver this paper calls noise. What do you mean?
So again, to simplify things down when you want to picture the simplest system. You don't have any noise in there. So you just put in a real simple ramping up of a stress. Your stress, say, would go from 1 to 10, and you would just slowly, you know, go 1, 2, 3, 4, sequentially all the way to 10. But again, that's not what happens. So if we look at, for example, temperature change across the globe, you know, sometimes it goes up quite a lot and then it goes down a little bit. So there's that little bit of noise in that overall increasing temperature system. And so what we did was essentially we inserted that back in to our stress to, again, make it more realistic. And this is the equivalent of extreme events. So, for example, if I go back to the temperature example, occasionally you get a heat wave, don't you? And that would be noise pushing it up, the temperature unexpectedly up a little bit. And then it might go down on the next time step, so in the next month or something like that. And so that's why we added noise into the model, to sort of capture the impacts of that.
Well, after 3 years of La Nina in the Pacific, we're now confident that we're entering an El Nino in coming months. Those are natural oscillations in the ocean states. They can modify the climate. Does that qualify as noise?
Yeah, yeah. Because essentially, they cause extreme events. It does tend to make, for example, the Amazon will be drier and hotter this year than it would have been in the La Nina years. First, essentially, that will provide an extreme value in the overall trend of increasing temperature. So that's exactly the kind of effect that we were trying to capture by putting noise into our signals.
Well, you found that every case you modeled has the capacity to speed up, but they did not all act the same or react equally to the same forces?
No, yes. Yeah. So we found that some systems were brought close to the present day by addition of another driver. So we had a primary driver, and if you added the secondary driver, that had a large effect, whereas other models showed that noise had a bigger effect. And all models, though, did show that the combination of multiple drivers and noise was generally the worst-case scenario, which is worrying because that's probably the most similar scenario to the present day.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with research scientist Simon Wilcock. New science warns of nasty surprises and perhaps ecosystem collapse could come sooner. And just the fact that we're not expecting extremes and breakdowns, we're not planning for them, isn't that another huge problem, Simon?
Yeah, that is a big problem. They're really hard to plan for, though, because effectively what we're talking about is low likelihood but high impact events. And there's a lot of uncertainty involved. So whilst we may be quite... We may think that a tipping point might happen in the Amazon, for example. It doesn't mean it will happen. If it just happens gradually or if it doesn't happen, then the differences are so extreme that it's really, really hard to plan for. One thing we can do, though, is essentially detect these things in advance better if we improve our monitoring. So if we monitor several stresses rather than just the easy-to-measure ones, if we just monitor the easy-to-measure ones, that's the equivalent of just looking at the primary driver, which we know would be a bad idea, because if the paper shows that if you only focus on the primary driver, then effectively these ecosystem collapses will happen unexpectedly, and that's because the stress of the secondary and tertiary drivers that you weren't looking at creeped up, and they caused the system to collapse. But by better monitoring, say, all three drivers in a system with three drivers, you'll see it coming better. You'll see this tipping point coming. You'll be able to react and be like, hang on, we're putting the ecosystem under too much stress here. We've picked up these warning signs, like the loss of resilience in the Amazon forest that I mentioned earlier. We've picked up on these warning signs, and then we've done something about it. So I think it's that kind of adaptive management that we need, and it has to be driven by better monitoring.
Well, here's a quick quote from the new paper in the journal Nature Sustainability. Overall, global warming will increase the frequency of unprecedented extreme events, raise the probability of compound events, and ultimately could combine to make multiple system failures more likely. So what is the role of what you call erratic events in accelerating the impact of climate change?
So essentially that's the noise we were talking about earlier. What seems to happen is that although the noise we had in our model could move the system towards a tipping point, it can make a stress worse, but it could also move the system away from that critical threshold. It could make the stress, you know, less bad. But because there's such a basically a cliff edge at that threshold that causes the tipping point, on average, the effect of the noise, these extreme events, is bad. Because if you say, if you reduce the temperature by 1 degree, that makes the system a little bit safer. But if you increase by 1 degree, that effectively plummets you off a cliff. So the average change was always quite extreme by adding noise.
Reading this free open access paper, I learned almost as much about what we don't know as what we do. What strikes you as key unknowns?
Yeah, there is quite a lot of unknowns here. So tipping points and these kind of abrupt changes, they're often most studied in what I would call a fluid system. So we have quite a lot of scientific studies looking at threshold-dependent changes in the atmosphere. So, for example, you know, temperature, carbon, and also in lakes. There's quite a lot of evidence from lakes going from clear to like an algae-filled state. But terrestrial ecosystems might behave a little differently. They might not be quite as connected because they're not as fluid. So actually, the collapses might not spread throughout the ecosystem in the same way. And also, I think we've only just really begun to grapple with how we can use the same kind of systems dynamics, the same kind of theories, in a positive way. So I think it's really in its infancy where we're beginning to understand, you know, how can we pull the levers to cause a positive tipping point and an unexpected recovery. And when we have that, when we've started to understand that, we can really start to harness what is essentially a bad news story in a really good, positive way.
Well, one of the qualities I love about good science is when authors are not afraid to raise limitations like that or even objections to their own work. What other cautions and disclaimers did your team add in?
Well, I think one of the main ones is these are models, right? Models don't always reflect reality. And so we need a lot more empirical data of real systems. But the bad news is, to get that empirical data of systems collapsing under stress of multiple drivers, effectively we need to collapse systems. And we can either wait for that to happen naturally, like in Lake Erhai, which is we mentioned in our paper, and that was one of the data sets that gives us encouragement that our models are showing the same thing, the right thing. Or we can do that experimentally. So currently I'm working on a project where we're building basically plots to put them under future climate extremes so that we can then watch to see what happens. So if they do critically fail, we can see whether that was under, say, just a temperature increase that we put them under, or did they go through that failure sooner if we put them under a temperature increase and flooded them, for example. So those kind of experiments is what we need, and that's what a lot of my collaborators and I are now moving on to, both in like glass houses, in greenhouses, but also in the field as well.
On June 22nd, along with co-authors John Deering and Gregory Cooper, you published an explainer for the public. And among other things, you caution ecological disaster cannot be fixed by governments like the bailouts of Western banks in 2008. Why not?
Well, essentially, because we don't have the same stock in the back of our pocket. You know, if you want to bail out a bank, effectively, you print a bit more money, don't you? If we want to bail out of an ecosystem, we can't suddenly print more species. That's not how it works. So essentially, nature has to bail itself out, and that doesn't obey our rules. If we can't, as of yet, push a button and cause an ecosystem to suddenly be like, oh, yeah, okay, I'm going to start recovering. Essentially, some of the research that I talked about earlier, where we can potentially harness the systems dynamics theory to increase rates of recovery. Essentially, that might give us a bit more of that power, but it's not something we can do today.
There was decent media coverage for this paper. The phrase ecological doom loops generated over 35,000 hits on Google within 4 days. It'll probably carry on as a meme, but I'm still pretty sure of two things. Most of the public won't know about this, and UK residents will keep flying to Spain in winter, even if the Spanish climate becomes like the Sahara. Where is the space for this new risk awareness to really take root?
I think in adaptive management. I think essentially what this experience shows is that if we monitor things, and if we monitor as many stresses as we can monitor, even if some of those stresses are quite hard to monitor, so potentially quite expensive, it is worth it. Because it's a better way of then forecasting whether the system we're interested in is basically going towards where it's going to be in trouble. And then we can avoid it. We can take action to start to change people's behavior, you know, maybe convince them to take the train to Spain instead. But we can only do that once we've given a red light. We've basically said, look, this is a danger sign. We really need to change behavior now. And enhanced monitoring of multiple stresses will really help us give that warning.
I was kind of surprised to find that you work with an agricultural research institute. You're a professor in sustainability. Is it a leap from that to the collision of climate change and the whole living world, as in this big paper?
I don't think so at all. So I sort of think of myself as a systems scientist. So I study multiple systems, and I often focus most on socio-ecological systems, so systems that have a bit of nature going on, but also some impacts of people. And that describes agriculture perfectly. You know, essentially, agriculture is us harnessing nature to grow food. And there's obviously a large human influence because you've got a lot of actions on behalf of the farmer and all the other farm workers. And essentially, many other ecosystems are also just socio-ecological systems. So, for example, if we consider a national park, we might have lots of ecology, lots of nature going on in that natural park, but you've also got pressure from people maybe going to visit the national park. And that kind of socio-ecological system, maybe the social part of it is smaller than the ecological part, but it's still a socio-ecological system, so it's still sort of within my area of expertise.
In conclusion, how much sooner did you find that big system breakdowns could happen?
We found that essentially there was a bit of a range, but if we have additional stresses and or noise, so more extreme events, we found that the collapses occurred about between roughly 38 to 81% closer to today than they would have if we just had one stress on the system, which is quite substantial.
Are you worried about it?
Yes, I am. I'm worried when you combine effectively the results of this paper with a couple of other papers, and we've sort of hinted about the Amazon quite a lot in this conversation. So essentially, what the paper that we've recently published shows is that there is a real risk with multiple drivers and extreme events of the Amazon move, well, any system, but the Amazon moving from a rainforest-like state to a savanna-like state. And if you couple that with, you know, a finding from last year that the Amazon is losing resilience, then maybe that starts to suggest that when we're talking about moving it towards the present day, maybe we're actually talking, oh, it's quite close to the present day. And then you couple it with a paper that we published in 2020 in Nature Communications that showed that once the Amazon does cross the threshold, it would only take, I think it was about 49 years to actually collapse. So if the collapse is happening soon, let's say 2030 or starting then, potentially it would then be over. It would be a savanna by 2080. And to be honest, that frightens me to be the last, in the last generation, amongst the last people that see the Amazon rainforest as a rainforest and not as a massive savanna. is really, really worrying, because obviously when it switches to a savanna, that could start a huge domino effect, because that will release a lot of carbon, that will increase global temperatures. If that increases global temperatures enough, then you have ice sheets melting, for example, which then maybe increases sea level rise, and that then would impact a whole world, basically, ecosystems, people, cities, and that's basically a domino effect that I would rather not start.
We have been speaking with Principal Scientist Simon Wilcock from Rothamsted Research and Bangor University in Wales. You can and should read this worrying new paper called Earlier Collapse of Anthropocene Ecosystems, Driven by Multiple Faster and Noisier Drivers, as published in Nature Sustainability. Find links to that and more about this paper in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Simon, thank you so much for giving your valuable time with us.
Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Texas is roasting in triple-digit heat week after week. Canada is still on fire. Heat blisters break out all over the world, including India and China, going beyond human endurance. Oceans have never been so hot, at least in the northern hemisphere. Where are we, and what is happening? Paul Beckwith is the Canadian scientist who tracks extreme climate change. He taught climate science at Canadian universities. Paul reported for Radio EcoShock from the COP26 climate conference in Glasgow. He makes science simple for the rest of us on his popular YouTube channel. From Ottawa, Canada, Paul Beckwith, a warm welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, and it's been a while for us.
It has been a while. It's just been so hectic trying to keep up with the climate science and with events predicted for years that are happening now. How has the air been in Ottawa lately?
We had our first taste of the very, very unhealthy air from the wildfire smoke back on June 6th was the first day. So it was a big deal for Ottawa because Ottawa has very little industry and the air quality is always exceptional here, or usually exceptional. So June 6th was bad, but June 7th broke all records. I think at that point Ottawa was the most polluted city in the world. On the air quality index, the U.S. air quality index, we reached 511. And that's the PM2.5 particles, particulate matter 2.5 micron diameter and smaller, are very unhealthy because they're so small they can get deep inside the body and even into the bloodstream eventually, cause all kinds of inflammation and harm. Those levels were over 500 micrograms per cubic meter. Now, to give you an idea, they say that 22 micrograms per cubic meter is equivalent to smoking one cigarette. So that was a well over a pack in that day for anybody that was outside, you know, men, women, their children, elderly, youth. Everybody was basically smoking over a pack of cigarettes that day. And same with Montreal. There's a very good chance that Montreal will get hit with this. And then, you know, a day or two out, it's going to be on the East Coast again. I think Boston is in the crosshairs right now. I mean, New York might miss the worst of it. So there's nothing that's gone down with the wildfires. There's more fires. They're sending more smoke. They're burning more area. It's just that the wind directions haven't been blowing the smoke into Canadian cities in the last little while. It stayed mostly up north, and it's gone across the Atlantic Ocean into Europe. So I know Ireland and Scotland and Spain, you know, it was going into countries like that. And exceptionally bad. I mean, it's the air current can sometimes refocus the particles. And I know when on June 7th, New York was hit. Well, Ottawa was hit June 7th. New York was hit a day or two later. And New York was a lot worse than Ottawa was in terms of, it looked like, or Mars. the sky was just orange and very, very difficult to breathe.
Yeah, this is really a global event. The EU's Copernicus satellite monitoring system just sent me a notice that Canadian wildfire smoke has officially reached Europe. People are underestimating what this means. Now, wildfires are made more likely by climate change. That makes sense. But can they also be a driver for more warming in themselves?
Absolutely, because they wipe out a strong sink of carbon. I mean, the boreal forest, which circumvents the planet in the northern hemisphere, is a vital sink for carbon dioxide. You know, as we burn more and more of the wild areas of the boreal forest, not only do you release the carbon, you know, while the fires are going on, but there's no absorption of the carbon anymore from the atmosphere. So you really, the ability of the forest to absorb carbon is greatly reduced. So CO2 levels will definitely go up in the atmosphere. You also get the smoke from the fires and actually travel right up into the Arctic and fall and darken the snow and ice up there, which leads to a very strong melting feedback because the darker surface absorbs a lot more sunlight. So this is a huge problem too. And what people don't talk about, I mean, forest fire is a bit of a misnomer because in the boreal forest, about 80% of the fuel that is burning is actually, it's the peatlands on the ground. It's the litter on the surface floor that's fallen branches and trees and needles, etc. And it's also the permafrost underneath that is starting to, you know, warm up and ignite. So 80% of that smoke is basically from the ground floor of the forest. I mean, the trees are also burning, you know, up to the crowns, but most of the smoke is from, you know, the moss and all the stuff that's on the surface of the forest.
Ooh, when you talk about peat fires, you kind of send a chill down my spine. In 1997-98, there were huge peat fires in Indonesia. It buried Asia as far as Singapore with smoke, but it also led to one of the warmest periods on record. Of course, it was also aided by El Nino, but peat fires, very, very serious. We had them in the Russian heat wave of 2010, too. The peat bogs all around Moscow and beyond were burning, and it was highly smoky and highly intensive carbon-releasing event.
Yes, there's a tremendous amount of carbon, you know, organic carbon within the peat and, you know, in the ground. And when that starts burning, you know, you have a huge problem. But also, you know, these fires have started so early this year in Canada, because sometimes, you know, when the fires start July and August, as long as they're not threatening infrastructure, they're just left to burn, because usually by the fall, you know, as temperature gets colder and there's more precipitation, the fires go out naturally. But, you know, they're starting in May and June, and, you know, if they don't put them out, they're going to burn all summer. So we're breaking all the records with the Canadian fires, and it's also happening in Siberia. You know, we've had record temperatures in Siberia and massive fires there, but we don't hear so much about those. But they are, you know, from satellite monitoring and other means, we can see they're producing tremendous amounts of smoke as well and burning up lots of the, they call it the taiga in Russia as opposed to boreal forest, but it's basically the same thing.
Let's move on to the extreme heat. Now, like the state of Florida, the government of Texas doesn't want to talk about climate change at all. They don't want to teach climate science in the schools. But it's amazing how that can happen, even as heat like nobody has ever seen just settles in for a long stay and punishes people there day after day. What do you know about this weird Texas heat dome?
Yes, so I have to get back to the jet streams because, so just a quick recap, I mean, they circumvent the Earth, and they exist because of the temperature difference. You know, the Arctic's cold, the equator's warm. So that temperature difference sets up a pressure gradient, which then gets the winds going, and they get concentrated or focused into these narrow pathways, which we call the jet streams. And, of course, as the Arctic is warming at much higher temperatures, you know, eight times the global average, and that temperature gradient to the equator is lowered, so the jet streams have to slow down. They slow down, they become wavier, and when you have very high peaks in the north-south direction of the jet stream, they tend to get stuck. Meteorologists call it kind of a blocking condition, and under a high-pressure area, there's very little rainfall, you know,
very high temperatures, very few clouds, so it all contributes to making it hotter and hotter. So we have one of this heat dome over Texas is exactly that. The jet stream is kind of locked in this configuration where it stays hot there for, you know, extended periods of time, hot and very dry. I mean, I think they're reaching temperatures over 50 degrees Celsius there. And it's been ongoing, you know, over most of the last month.
Yep, 120 in the shade, as they would say in the United States. Paul, are we in the hottest time since humans, as we know ourselves, began?
Certainly, we're right up there. And I think this El Nino, which is just getting started, will push us to break all records by a large, significant margin. We've had the cooling phase of the EMSO, the El Nino Southern Oscillation variability, and there's been a tremendous amount of heat that has been stored within the oceans as a result. And that heat is shallowing, and we're setting record temperatures by far in the North Atlantic, for example. Off the UK, I believe it's 5 degrees Celsius warmer than normal, the oceans. And in the Southern Hemisphere, around Antarctica, we're getting extremely warm sea surface temperatures, and we're getting warming of the water down below, which is increasing the melt rates, and the whole ocean circulation patterns seem to be shifting. So we're facing huge consequences from all these years where we've had more and more heat being trapped in the Earth system.
Lately, you have been widening your view. Tell us about your recent video called Vicious Accelerating Feedbacks Between Far-Right Politics and Climate Catastrophe.
Unfortunately, some of the things that occur as a result of accelerating climate change is, you know, there's areas of the planet which become less suitable to supporting human life. And as a result, we're seeing record amounts of people being displaced from their homelands, from their cities, or even from their countries. So there's migration, tremendous amounts of migration. These people have to go somewhere. And climate migrants, if you like, go to countries that have, you know, a bit of uncertainty in the political systems. And basically, if parties are on the left leaning, they tend to let in, you know, they tend to be more humanitarian in terms of we'll take these people, you know, as many people as we can, et cetera. And then the right-wing elements within the country and the political system say, hey, you know, wait a minute, we don't want all of these people, you know, taking jobs and taking resources, et cetera. We can't afford them. You know, they burden our system. So then there's a backlash against the immigrants. And a lot of these backlashes can lead to, you know, right-wing governments getting in. And then when the right-wing governments are in, then they basically get rid of the climate policies, what little there is. You know, then climate continues to worsen around the world when enough of this happens in countries. So there's all of these feedbacks. You know, we often talk about feedbacks, whether they be, you know, positive feedbacks, which are not positive. There's nothing good about them. They're accelerating the changes that happen. So you can think accelerating feedbacks, making things worse when you hear positive feedbacks. And then negative feedbacks, which, you know, cause a sort of slowing down of the changes. I mean, in the climate system, physically, we seem to be having mostly positive feedbacks, making things worse. But now we can talk about the feedbacks to humans and our actions and what we do. And a lot of these are positive feedbacks, which are accelerating the climate change problem. So you get in this sort of vicious loop, you know, where climate worsens and worsens, and there's more and more migration. And then there's more and more climate change as a result, because a lot of the policies are just thrown away by the governments that come in. So there's all of these sort of things going on. And I think people in governments kind of get overwhelmed by all of the things that are happening so quickly. And as a result, poor decisions are made. They're all short-term decisions, you know, in the moment sort of things, knee-jerk reactions. And these things are not conducive to making any headways against climate change or any other issues for that matter, really.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. Ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Canadian climate system scientist Paul Beckwith, returning with the big picture on the climate shift. You and I have talked at least a half dozen times about Arctic sea ice, one of your specialties. What is the latest?
Yes, there's always a lot happening in the Arctic. And, you know, often the sea ice is talked about, which we'll do that again. But let's not forget the snow cover in the Arctic in the spring, because basically the Arctic is getting a lot darker because of we're losing the sea ice. We're also losing the snow cover in the spring. And a darker Arctic absorbs more energy, and that increases the temperature amplification in the Arctic compared to the rest of the planet, which then, you know, has that huge effect I've already discussed on slowing the jet streams. So a paper came out just recently that actually tried to really kind of get a handle on, you know, when we can expect the Arctic sea ice to essentially vanish. When summer, you know, when mid-September in the not-too-distant future, we're going to have what I call the Blue Ocean event, where there's very little sea ice left at the end of the summer melt season. Usually it's defined as less than a million square kilometers. So the date of that happening, in the IPCC, the last version, the Assessment Report 6, they came to the conclusion from papers that, yes, in intermediate and high-emission scenarios, we would completely lose the Arctic sea ice, but not before 2050, 2060 even. And in the low emission scenarios, we'd never lose it. So this new paper, it looks at the CMIP-6 modeling, all of these different models to model sea ice, and it found that they weren't really even, if you run the backwards, they weren't matching up to the observations. You know, what they did in this paper was a very simple concept. They took the CMIP-6 models, the most sophisticated computer models on sea ice. They ran them backwards. They found that they were way much higher than the observations. So they then forced the models by scaling factors to match the observations in the past. And then they ran them forward using those same scaling factors. And they found that the sea ice would vanish under all emission scenarios, including the low emission scenario. And under the intermediate and high emission scenarios, it could vanish as early as the late 2030s. So they basically moved the vanishing date likelihood up by over a decade, from 2050s to late 2030s. So basically that's it. It was a very simple idea. But I mean, combining the sophisticated models with the observations, so they're all self-consistent, they got a more realistic picture. I think it's still a bit conservative. Yeah, I think it will happen sooner. Some people are saying, you know, we could have this Blue Ocean event during this phase of the El Nino. If we have a super El Nino, it looks like we might be heading that way. And also, you know, if you look at the heat going into the Arctic from the atmosphere, also from the oceans, the ocean sea surface temperatures and the currents underneath the ocean, you can see that these things are all, you know, attacking and reducing sea ice. And what's also happening at the same time is the same thing is happening to Antarctica. I mean, for decades there, Antarctica sea ice was pretty stable. It actually was increasing, I think, about 1.5% per decade or something, but it's dropped off a cliff in the last decade or so, and it's setting record lows. And we're not talking about just a record low. We're talking about many, many standard deviations below anything that's in the records. So this is happening in Antarctica as well, which is very concerning.
Another underestimated stress point is simply having enough food for over 8 billion people. So I watched your video called Wheat Yields in the USA and China Threatened by Heat Waves Breaking Enzymes. What is that about?
Yes, well, over the years, people have been working trying to make crops more heat resistant. It's interesting because, you know, we had the so-called Green Revolution where we were able to double and then double again and double again for many different doubling periods, the yields, the amount of food that we could
get in terms of, you know, whether it be maize, like the corns or wheats or grains, we greatly improved yields per hectare. We didn't increase farmland that much, but we increased the amount of food that we could grow, and we improved farming techniques and so on, you know, drip irrigation, more places being irrigated, the fertilizers, which are fossil fuel derived, of course. But we're reaching a limit. I mean, like any other plant, you can reach a limit, and the temperature can actually be so warm that the crop itself just can no longer tolerate it. It just can't grow. It's just too hot. It desiccates, and the protein molecules, you know, when you cook an egg, what you're basically doing is you're getting denaturation of the protein bonds in the egg. I mean, enzymes are biological catalysts. They're very important for chemical reactions in the living plant or living animal. So there's lots of enzymes that work. And these enzymes just break down. They lose their properties. They're no longer able to function as enzymes when the temperature gets too high. The yields plummet when that sort of thing happens. So we're reaching temperatures, you know, in many, many wheat-producing areas where that can happen. So yields aren't just going to drop slowly. You reach, it's a threshold, another one of these threshold things, nonlinear processes where you're okay to a certain point and then suddenly the yield will collapse.
Now, Germany is building 10 new ports to import liquefied natural gas. Vietnam is counting on LNG. Country after country says they are going with gas. They say gas is greener, but it is all just methane, really, the same methane you have been warning about for over a decade. Paul, how do you feel about a world powered by methane?
Methane was touted as, you know, a bridge fuel. And, you know, the term natural gas, right? I mean, some marketing genius said, hey, let's call the methane natural gas, and we can heat our homes with natural gas. I mean, natural gas sounds great. It's natural, right? Unfortunately, you know, it's a very potent greenhouse gas. You know, has an enormous global warming potential compared to CO2, and a lot of it, it's since 2010, we're getting a lot more of it being produced from the wetlands around the planet, you know, as the wetlands are heating and drying, or rainfall patterns change. So people are counting on natural gas, and in order to transport it, it's very difficult to transport a gas in volume. You know, this is, oil is perfect, right? As a liquid, it's easily transportable. Basically, natural gas is a gas, of course, and they cool it down until it's liquefied. So they have to keep it at very, very low temperatures and transport it that way. So it's very expensive and very bulky to do. But, you know, some countries, are, as you say, are going that way. I mean, we're burning more and more fossil fuels than ever on this planet. I mean, the world goes through about 100 million barrels per day, and we also go through about 60 million barrel equivalents per day of so-called natural gas / methane. It's all increasing, and any time you use methane and you have a leak rate, if you have a leak rate of the methane into the atmosphere from your pipelines of 1% or 2%, then you could argue, well, methane, when you burn it, it's cleaner burning, it produces less CO2. But if there's, I mean, we're not experiencing leak rates that low. We're experiencing leak rates 5 to 10% on most pipelines and systems, and therefore methane is worse than, or just as bad as burning coal in terms of the effect on climate with very, very high leak rates. So it's not, it's no solution at all. It's just extending the problem.
I totally agree. Now, moving on to AI, papers already credit machine learning or deep learning. Do you think artificial intelligence will help humans understand climate and the real-life systems we live in?
That's sort of a hope. I mean, of course, AI, there's loads of opposing views on AI. It's going to destroy humanity all the way to, it's going to save humanity. It's going to solve, you know, some of the issues like climate change that we haven't even been able to make any sort of dent in, because basically our entire society is predicated on burning fossil fuels. I think if scientists start to incorporate AI into their, you know, their thinking on if you're looking at climate solutions, if you're looking how to make, say, cement that doesn't emit CO2, or if you're looking at phytoplankton in the ocean to capture carbon, or growing things like kelp, having kelp farms or things like that, I think AI could be used as a tool to do a lot of simulations that might save you from making mistakes, and might help identify which technologies can have the most promise and things like that. So it's very double-edged, like any other technology. But we haven't talked about the James Hansen paper, Global Warming in the Pipeline, yet. He's working on another one, Global Sea Level Rise in the Pipeline. He's also working on his book, Sophie's Planet, which I'm hoping is sort of like an updated version of Storms of Our Grandchildren. But we basically we're really running out of time very fast to try to stabilize our climate system. Well, Hansen, ever since he testified in Congress in, 1988 or something, he's been trying to raise alarm bells about climate, and we haven't, just look at greenhouse gas levels over time and plot the dates of all the climate conferences on that graph, and we're nowhere near addressing this issue, this problem.
So how can we find out more about Hansen's work?
I did a video summary of it. It's a very technical paper. There's a lot in there. I'll revisit it soon. I'm gonna try to create some video shorts, and I'm going to make a debut on here's a commitment. I'm going to make a debut on TikTok. I'm going to try to do some videos on TikTok with just some of the key points of Hansen's findings, right? I'm just trying to figure out ways to get the message out more because it's very important. But in a nutshell, if you look from 2010 back to the late 70s, 80s, over that time period, our planet was warming about 0.18 degrees Celsius per decade. Now, look at what happens after 2010. Basically, the warming rate has upticked significantly, it looks like, but it's still too early to know for sure. But Hansen's been arguing that the warming rate has notched upwards, and it's notched upwards between 50 and 100%. So he draws two curves, and we're somewhere probably in between them, according to Hansen's latest paper, Global Warming in the Pipeline. So I said it was 0.18 degrees Celsius per decade rise since up to 2010. Since 2010, it's 0.27 degrees Celsius per decade up to 0.36 degrees Celsius per decade. So that's either a 50% increase or 100% increase. And there's lots of reasons for this. One of the big reasons is that the Earth energy imbalance has greatly increased. If there was no imbalance, the Earth would be stable temperature overall, the whole system. But as long as the Earth energy imbalance is positive, then you're going to get warming. And the higher it is, the more warming you're going to get. And one of the big factors, it looks like, is that we've had a reduction of aerosols over the ocean specifically since 2015, and an even bigger reduction in 2020. Of these, it's basically marine fuels have sulfur in them, and the requirements on the amount of sulfur have been tightened significantly in 2015 by the International Maritime Organization, and also in 2020 they were tightened again. Now, over the oceans, there's very few aerosols because the sources are mostly land-generated. Some over the ocean, like from plankton, the dimethyl sulfide, a few other things, but most of the aerosol, it's pretty clean environment in the air over the oceans. So any ships crisscrossing the ocean would put up these aerosols from their smokestacks, and they would, it's not just ones you could see, but they would spread far and wide, and they would cause a huge cooling of those regions of the ocean. So we're not getting that to the same extent now. And this could be another reason why we're seeing extremely high ocean temperatures, and they happen to coincide for the most part with areas of very, very high shipping.
So I think there's a direct relationship going on here, but this needs to be confirmed by peer-reviewed science, which, you know, it's too early for that to have been done. But I think that might be one reason why the ocean temperatures are going crazy right now.
Well, we're out of time, and we're out of time in this interview, unfortunately. From Ottawa, we've been talking with the climate system scientist and science communicator, Paul Beckwith. You can find links to the videos we talked about and all Paul's work in my show blog at ecoshock.org. And you can learn the fact of climate change by searching for Paul H. Beckwith on YouTube. It's like a free university for everybody, and the science comes out in real time as it's published. Paul, thank you for your work and working for us all, really.
Well, thank you so much, Alex. And, you know, I have to give you a big shout out and thank you to your work over the years with Radio EcoShock. It's, you know, we're all trying to do our bit, right? Because we understand, you know, what's going on with the climate systems.
Yes, we love life and we know that big trouble is coming, so we should try and change. I'm Alex Smith. Check out all our past programs free at ecoshock.org.
Way too crazy, way too hot. Normal, normal is what she's not.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The Pentagon, Climate Change, War, and U.S. Military Emissions. Nita Crawford, Professor in International Relations at the University of Oxford. She co-founded the Costs of War Project at Brown University in 2010 and currently serves as a project co-director. Nita Crawford spoke at the Mahindra Center at Harvard University on September 29, 2022. She was introduced by Makeda Best, curator of photography at the Harvard Art Museums.
I first learned about Dr. Crawford's research and on the military's use of fossil fuels in 2019 when I read her paper, Pentagon Fuel Use, Climate Change, and the Cost of War. I was acquiring photographs for the Harvard Art Museums that depicted a region in central Louisiana where there is a large concentration of fossil fuel production. Stacy Kranitz's deep, dense compositions of fences and foliage are emblematic of what Dr. Crawford describes in her current book as the deep cycle, or the relationship between economic growth, fossil fuel use, American wars, and foreign oil dependency. Indeed, by recognizing the fact that these corporations operate on the same lands where enslaved peoples once worked, Kranitz deepens the connections to histories of war and economic power. Dr. Crawford introduced me to the concept of climate change as a threat multiplier, and thus I began to see works like Kranitz's as landscapes of war. In her 2019 paper, Dr. Crawford pointed out that the U.S. is preparing for threats of attack from human adversaries. While global warming is the most certain and immediate of any of the threats the U.S. faces over the next several decades. Now, with such events as the publication of the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and the ongoing Russian war on Ukraine have prompted renewed discussions of oil, conflict, and climate, Dr. Crawford has published her new book, The Pentagon, Climate Change and War. The book provides perspectives on the links between the U.S. military and mainstream climate science, for example, and an especially enlightening section to me was her writing on the ways the military influenced the development of modern climate science. After she earned her Ph.D. in political science from MIT, Dr. Crawford embarked on an extraordinarily prolific career of writing for scholarly journals and general interest media, including the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and the Chronicle of Higher Education. In addition to the book we've all gathered here to hear about today, Dr. Crawford is the author of Accountability for Killing, Moral Responsibility for Collateral Damage in America's Post-9/11 Wars, published in 2013. She was a co-winner of the 2003 American Political Science Association's Jervis and Schroeder Award for Best Book in Environmental History and Politics. Consistent in her scholarship is her interest in competing values and notions of individual and collective moral responsibility, as she has written, quote, military organizations are moral agents, and a focus on pathways for institutional change. Another notable feature of Dr. Crawford's work is the sheer amount of data she offers. One of her peers made the observation that, quote, she single-handedly gathers and analyzes data of such a vast quantity that the result resembles an NGO rather than an individual. It's not an NGO, but Dr. Crawford is also one of the founders of the Cost of War Project at Brown University's Watts Institute, which she co-directs with Catherine Lutz and Stephanie Saville. Begun in 2010, the team includes 50 scholars, legal experts, human rights practitioners, and physicians. Cost of War uses research and their website to, quote, foster democratic discussion of the post-9/11 wars in Iraq and Afghanistan by providing the fullest possible account of their human, economic, and political costs, and to foster better informed public policies. Dr. Crawford is the Montague Burton Chair in International Relations at Oxford University. Previously, she was professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Boston University. And since 2017, she has served on the board of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Advocacy Organization, Council for a Livable World. Please welcome Dr. Crawford.
You know, that introduction was really beautiful, and I thank you for it. But I want to begin by saying thanks to all of you who are my friends and colleagues who've come to this event. What I want to do today is run through some of the major arguments in this book, which I wrote for MIT Press, and I thank Anthony Zanino and my acquiring editor, Beth Clevenger. I don't know if you're here, but thank you so much for forcing me to write it. Basically at knife point, really fast. So all errors are there, my fault. Okay, so the theme that I'm going to talk about today, the scale of U.S. military missions, I'm just going to give you some data and go very quickly through that, because what I really want to get at is this deep cycle that was mentioned earlier, war as a driver of emissions and industrialization. And then I'd like to talk about the military's role in climate science and climate change negotiations, again, breezing through that very quickly and talk about how the military thinks about climate change, get to the facts that there's securitization and militarization, I'm going to explain those terms, happening right now, and it has been for the last 50 years with the military and climate change, and then I'll talk about the way that the military is thinking about resilience and adaptation and mitigation and the question of war. So there's many ways to think about emissions. Last year, the Pentagon's emissions were 51 million metric tons. The year before that, they were 51 million metric tons. In 2019, they were 54 or 55 million metric tons CO2 equivalent. And that's enormous. And what I wanted to do with this slide is basically just have you think about emissions per capita. The military's emissions per capita are more intense than civilian emissions. That's the point here, right? So the military is a very intensive user of fossil fuel, and military industry is as well. And what we have is a kind of perspective that I think we rarely get, which is that energy consumption of the entire U.S. government is dominated by the Department of Defense. The Department of Defense is the world's largest greenhouse, single institutional greenhouse gas emitter. It's the United States' largest energy user, institutionally, single energy user. So the share of total U.S. government energy consumption, it's actually declining. The DOD's energy consumption is actually declining. So it was around 87% of all U.S. government energy consumption was the military, the DOD, and now it's about 76%, still the largest user. DOD emissions of greenhouse gases, mostly carbon but also methane and nitrous oxide, are fluctuating. One thing to note is the overall decline since the Vietnam War. You also see spikes depending on what's happening. So there's a spike in the Reagan buildup, and there's a spike in 1991 with the Gulf War. That's the highest on the chart here, 110 million metric ton CO2 equivalent. And then it's declining until the post-9/11 wars begin. And it goes up to 85 million metric tons. Okay, but now let's think about this in another perspective. The U.S. military emits more CO2 than many nations. Okay, the other thing we need to keep in mind is military-industrial emissions, and I'm not going to talk a lot about that today, but it's important to think about this because military emissions are part of the story, but military-industrial emissions are a significant part of emissions. Mostly what I'm talking about today are the military emissions, but military-industrial emissions are about the same magnitude as military emissions. Okay, so it's hard to wrap your head around it. So about 15 to 17% of the United States industrial economy is military and aerospace. Then that's based on employment. Okay. So if you do that calculation, you get a number. I did it based an estimate based on the emissions of the top 12 defense contractors. Lockheed Martin is the largest, Northrop Grumman, General Dynamics, these are the big three. Military industrial emissions are as emitting as the DoD. So again, the size of entire countries like Denmark. Okay, so now the deep cycle, very quickly. A deep cycle is my notion, you know, thinking about international relations as I do, as something that unfolds over hundreds of years, where institutions and ideas and material reality reinforce each other. What I'm trying to describe is how the military technology and military fuel use promoted military industrialization, changed commercial, that is civilian consumption and commercial industry, affected relations between the United States or any other country and oil producing countries through bases and other kinds of arrangements, supplying weapons and so on. We begin when the United States moves away from arms and legs, and all militaries move away from arms and legs and draft horses and so on, oxen, powering them, to when they get steam engines powered by coal. So they move away from sort of natural power and the winds. You know, so if the wind stops blowing, the ship is becalmed. So what fuel gives you is not just speed, but independence from nature. And the tight relationship between military industry, which is also using fossil fuels to make the weapons. So Matthew Perry is an interesting figure. I have his the Japanese depiction of the forced opening of Japan, because Perry is not just trying to open commercial relationships, but he's trying to get coal depots and a coal supply in the Far East. That's part of his mission. So the U.S. also depended on British infrastructure at this time, but the British, being the largest naval power, needed their own independent infrastructure in the late 19th century, early 20th century. And they are coincidentally, and not so coincidentally, reliant on the coal that they produce, coal and Newcastle, but coal is the thing that they have, which allows them to become dominant in this mode of transportation, steam-powered, at first, steamships that are using both sails and water wheels, but then engines with propellers that are powered by steam and then later oil. So this is why people said in the 19th century that coal may be considered as the lifeblood of the man of war, and upon its supply depends your existence as a living factor in the battle equation. Here you see depicted the United States Navy's Great White Fleet, which makes a voyage between 1907 and 1908, circumnavigating the globe on coal, and they have to rely on the British to supply some of that coal, and they're trying to get local coal, and it becomes enlightening to the Roosevelt administration and later when they realize that they can't do it all themselves. And they have an incentive to get more coal that's controlled by the United States. And this is the ironically titled Great White Fleet, which is so dirty that they had to carry around extra cans of white paint because the coal would stick to the sides of the ship. So fast forwarding to World War I, Lord Curzon says the Allies floated to victory on a wave of oil. Of course, he's the leader of the House of Lords. He's in the war cabinet. That's partially true. They did. But they're also still dependent on coal. There's a mixture there. And after the war, what you see is the development of United States Army Air Force and aerial refueling, and ships are no longer really alone in sucking up a lot of the fuel needs. Aircraft becomes much more significant. And then quickly I want to say something about the role of oil in World War II. Clearly the Japanese were unhappy when the United States cut off oil exports in June 1941. Oil was one of the things that the Japanese needed for their strategy, so they tried to get it from Manchuria in the 1930s, and they were successful. But they also had other parts of their conquest strategy driven by the need for oil. The U.S. is, of course, trying to stop their access to oil, and they start sinking the Japanese ships, which have oil on them, going to Japanese military industry. In World War II, in addition, the Allies bombed the Germans because they were coal rich. They had to get oil from elsewhere. Okay, so then the deep cycle is also at work in post-war technological and social innovations that are spurred by war, promoted by military industry. For example, the commercial aircraft industry is bolstered by the giving away of aircraft after World War I and World War II to the commercial airplane industry. The U.S. highway system in the 1950s is about evacuation from the threat of nuclear war. And it's also, the highway system is meant to facilitate military industry as well. You get plastics, you get ammonium nitrate, which was used in bombs, going to soil in the form of fertilizer, and then that becomes nitrous oxide, which is a potent greenhouse gas. It's almost 300 times more potent than carbon dioxide. In addition, there's deforestation that occurs in war that's deliberate and sometimes not. And this image is of the burning of the Shenandoah Valley in 1864, deliberate burning to try to bring misery to the Confederacy, but it happens to destroy lots of forest. And you also see the way that trees were used, cut down and used to make roads, very quick roads. Taking us up to the present, the consequences of attacking oil fields, which is a strategy that doesn't just end in World War II, but continues into the Iraqi deliberate destruction of their own and Kuwaiti oil facilities, to the United States destruction of ISIS oil infrastructure, and more recently, the deliberate, apparently, destruction of natural gas infrastructure, Nord Stream 1 and 2. Those images are of bubbles of natural gas, which is mostly methane, a gas that is 24 times more potent, has a greater greenhouse gas intensity than carbon dioxide. Okay, that's a lot of the big picture, and what I want to do now is describe how the United States system, this is Defense Logistics Agency distribution of fuel, and they say our footprint is global. It is. It's in every part of the world. They have this capacity to distribute, store and distribute fuel, whatever kind is needed, Navy special fuel, jet fuel, diesel fuel, and so on. And these distribution centers are at bases and in close relationship with allies. And there's about 750 U.S. overseas bases that they're in charge of getting fuel to. Okay, so now I'm going to summarize the deep cycle of fossil fuel use, growth, and military strategy. It begins with cheap and versatile oil. It then moves to civilian and military demand for petroleum. You get dependence and the production of infrastructure. You want to maintain supply You don't want to be vulnerable. So your concern extends to threats in the future, for instance, political instability in producing countries, increasing price, and the possibility that oil may run out. So this insecurity about price, access, and diminished supply gets you to attempts to decrease insecurity. So you increase your military capacity and presence in areas like the Persian Gulf where oil is found. You develop economic and diplomatic ties to oil producers. You choose winners and losers in those societies, and that can create instability itself. Then increased military spending, arms purchases, and the presence in oil and gas-producing regions and lines of communication create their own vulnerabilities that you have to defend against. But there's this way out that we often don't take, which is attempts to break the cycle of fossil fuel dependency, this deep cycle, by diversifying energy sources, using renewables, developing alternatives to fossil fuel technologies, and so on. And we could reduce consumption. There's an idea. Okay, so that's the deep cycle. How does the military think about national security and climate change? I want to tell you a couple things about how they think about it. First of all, they understand climate science. They anticipate its impact, that is, climate change impact on the institution itself, and they're concerned about climate change-caused war coming to a neighborhood near you. So, how do they understand climate change? They paid for the research that tells us about it. Roger Revelle, in 1956, is asking for money to understand the impact of increased warming in the Arctic. So he says, we are now the greatest maritime nation on Earth. If the Russian coastline increases by something like 2,000 miles or so, the Russians will become a great maritime nation. Therefore, he needs money to study climate change. And Revelle and co-author Hans Suess, in research funded by the Department of the Navy, write in 1957 in a scientific journal, human beings are now carrying out a large-scale geophysical experiment of a kind that could not have happened in the past, nor be reproduced in the future. Within a few centuries, we are returning to the atmosphere and oceans the concentrated organic carbon stored in sedimentary rocks over hundreds of millions of years. Some of these same people, including Roger Revelle, tell President Johnson that they're engaged in this experiment, and on, they tell Carter. Okay. Fast forwarding to 1997, there's an opportunity in the international community to understand and reduce global greenhouse gas emissions. And it's negotiations in Kyoto. The Pentagon says they don't want anything. They want to be exempted from any emissions reductions or even reporting. Then they lobby. President Clinton agrees. Al Gore agrees. They get what they call everything they wanted in terms of not having reporting. Essentially, it's saying the United States does not have to, nor does any other country, according to the Kyoto Protocol, say what its military emissions are. If they talk about military, any sort of military-related emissions, they can concatenate it, put it in with commercial aircraft emissions, for example, so you wouldn't know what was military, what was civilian. So, this is the way it works. In 2015, at Paris, the far right was concerned that this would go away, this opacity, and they lobbied. And it's now voluntary that a country could tell their emissions from the military. They don't, for the most part, or they mix them in with their civilian emissions. Now, how else does the Pentagon think about it? Well, they're anticipating bad things happening to their bases. Bad things have already happened, and they've been studying this for a couple of decades. And here's one of their maps of the installations that are already suffering climate-related impacts. Here is Diego Garcia, a U.S. facility in the Indian Ocean, which we lease from Britain. It is vulnerable to sea level rise. Parts of it are only 8 feet above sea level, something like that. Okay, how else do they think about it? They have responded by making a great green fleet. Remember the great White fleet, the great green fleet runs on a mix of 10% biofuel, mostly beef fat, and 90% petroleum. That's the great green fleet. And they've also developed carinata seed, that is Ethiopian mustard, to put on aircraft. And there's a 50-50 mix. And in 2008, they showed that they could run their aircraft on this. And people in the Air Force are like, well, we proved it in 2008. Why don't we do this? Okay, that's a question. The other thing they're doing is promoting their sustainability. And they've actually, as I've said, succeeded in reducing their emissions at installations quite a lot. In fact, their reductions are so significant that they've already almost reached their target. In other words, and the Navy said that they would reduce their emissions completely and go net zero by 2050. They have reduced their emissions quite a bit. The Army said that they would reduce their emissions by 50% by 2030. When they published that number based on a 2005 baseline, they had already reduced their emissions by 42%. So they're very close. So there's one way to think about it. They've been ambitious. The other way to think about it is these goals are not ambitious. They're almost already there. All right. But the other thing that I wanted to mention is the securitization of climate change. People are scared that climate change war is coming to a neighborhood near them. And the DOD didn't used to say this, but now they do. The whole national intelligence estimate in 2021 focused on this, talked about climate change effects of different levels of warming, and talked about impacts to human security. And these are some: tropical cyclones, effects of biodiversity, effects of rising temperature, precipitation and flooding, causing people to move. Migration is a major concern that they focus on. And then assuming that there will be instability in vulnerable places, they think, as I said, climate change war may be coming to a neighborhood out there or maybe to you. Okay, so then what you see is the Navy, again, is in the lead, and they say that climate change instability is the threat that they think is more likely. This is Chief of U.S. Pacific Command in 2013, Locklear. It's more likely than other scenarios, including war with China. Okay, and even Secretary of Defense Mattis said needed to be concerned. In 2021, in preparation for the Glasgow meeting, the Conference of the Parties, there were four documents that came out of the government. There was a document by the DOD, their climate risk analysis, where they're anticipating the conflict, where there's climate change caused stresses, and more difficulty in the operating environment. And I'm going to read this one because it's vital here. As climate change converges with other drivers, especially geostrategic competition, emerging technology, and global demographic trends, it is reshaping the risk landscape. An increasingly accessible Arctic has already emerged as a competitive space with national security implications, including competition over resources such as fish, et cetera. The corrosive impact of these trends will make nations increasingly vulnerable to domestic insecurity, with sweeping implications for regional and border security and core national security interests of the United States, right? Simultaneously, revisionist nations will seek to exploit climate change-induced instability to erode the rules-based order that is central to the security and prosperity of the United States and its allies. So, revisionist nations will seek to erode the rules-based order. That we're talking about there is Russia and China. Then you see in the National Intelligence Estimate, another document that came out at the same time, the focus of their attention right there is Central Africa, which is a region that has produced the least greenhouse gas, but which will be affected greatly. And they're also looking at India, Pakistan, and some island nations as areas that will be highly vulnerable not just to climate change, but to conflict. So the question is that inevitable? Does climate change lead to war? The research shows that that's not necessarily so. It depends on how governments react to the stresses of climate change. And that's where I'm going to end.
That was Nita Crawford, professor in international relations at the University of Oxford. She's the author of The Pentagon, Climate Change and War, Charting the Rise and Fall of U.S. Military Emissions, MIT Press. She spoke at a book release event on September 29, 2022, at Harvard University. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website. My name is Maria Gelöden. Thank you for listening.